Lux is a new collaboration, relatively new. It's a young collaboration, so we don't have any data in the upfront. I'll talk to you about plans for Lux, which is hopefully going to be the leading development in this category in a bit. Uh-oh. There we go. That's not gonna work. I see. So I should have just brought my monitor there. Yeah, that's. Because I think that happened to our slides now. It's not this one. Sorry about this. Now I think. Oh, you don't have the Mac.
Do you need a dongle?
Yeah, I need a dongle. Okay. Taking up 10 minutes of my time. Experts. it's tech display is what you usually have.
Yeah,
you need mirroring too.
Yeah, turn on mirror displays.
Oh, sorry.
I'll change it. Works.
1024.
It works.
Yeah, it did not come out right when I thought of that.
Doing things.
Stop doing things. Let me try that. Okay. It'll be wrong size. I think it won't work.
Oh, it works.
Okay. Enough. Okay. So, just carrying on from there. We're right now 11 member institutions. We show 10 here, these universities in there. What's not shown is the latest edition, which is Moscow Engineering. All in all, about closing in on 50 people now. So it's getting to be a rather big size collaboration. Here's from about a year ago collaboration picture off the street. Okay, so what is the technique? This is going to be a two-phase TPC. And as different from earlier similar detectors, we will be locating the detector inside a large water tank. So what you see here is a 6-meter diameter water tank. And inside of the tank, the blue cylinder here is the detector itself. And then up there is a platform and all the electronics, et cetera, and the cryogenics located above here. And this gives you a scale of the detector. The detector itself is essentially a cylindrical volume, which is filled with liquid xenon. and under electric field with two arrays of PMTs, top and bottom, viewing the detector for HDM challenge. Okay. All right, so let me just go ahead and describe the technique a little better. Here's a schematic of the detector. You have the two PMT arrays, you have the liquid xenon, and the top, about 10 centimeters or so, is in the gaseous phase. So that's why it's a two-phase xenon detector, similar to the xenon 10 concept or Zeppelin. Now you have several different grids placed inside of the, axially along the cylinder, providing different fields. So there is a drift field inside the liquid, right around the surface an extraction field, and I'll tell you more about that. And finally, there is an acceleration field in the gaseous phase. So when you have an interaction, a recoil of either a neutron or electron, there's a prompt scintillation light shown here, and that's viewed by both sets of PMTs. And then there's also ionization, which the Amaro ionization that escapes recombination drifts upwards in the liquid and is extracted at the surface and then accelerated, which goes through photoluminescence and creates more light. And we show those two lights here with their characteristics. The prompt light is not only prompt, it's very sharp, relatively sharp, but you know, less than 100 nanosecond wide. And that we call S1, the primary. And then there's a long drift time of the order of almost half a millisecond, depending on how deep the event was. And the light that the secondary produces is that's characterized by the drift time, of the electron in the gaseous phase, because it emits light all along its path, and that's more like a microsecond. So those are very two distinct signals. But having the two signals essentially helps you beat down backgrounds. So I'll describe that in more detail. Now, the approach we've taken is the following. So what are the key points that we are interested in? First of all, you obviously want to maximize your wimp rate. So that just means two things. Choice of xenon as a target, and I'll come back to that a little bit, and also large total mass. So our goal for LUX is 100 kilograms of fiducial mass in the target, a total mass of about 350 kilograms of xenon. So that's on the signal side. And then essentially what you want to do is minimize internal backgrounds and absorb or tag external backgrounds. So in that, along those lines, we're working on some new sensor developments, but mostly it's being done by industry, and we're taking advantage of that. We've tried to find lower background materials. For example, the cryostat is made out of titanium, not copper. So it is, in that case, it's not really lower background, it's cheaper for the same amount of background. And there's been a large development in purification techniques at Case University and Yale. In terms of, as I already mentioned, external backgrounds, we have the water Cherenkov detector, and we're also considering, as an upgrade, a scintillator, a liquid scintillator bottle around the detector. So okay, now I think what is more critical about such detectors, not having run something this large before, in this particular technology, I think we'll have to really pay attention to stable operations. So we're designing in a very extensive sort of over-redundant monitoring of systems, etc., and frequent calibration, in situ perhaps, or at least using external sources. We're even considering, as I said, this is a new development, Krypton 83 metastable state, which has a very nice 9 keV line that we want to use for calibration. Okay, so why xenon? I'm sure you've seen this plot many times before, but just to reiterate, there are two things shown here for particular. It doesn't matter exactly what the which cross section is assumed, because it's a relative issue that we talk about here. These are cross sections, but these are rates. And as you can see, the cross section, you know, will have a diffractive zero at some point. And for xenon, the curve is steeper. And not only that, at lower Nicoid energies is higher than germanium or argon. So we take advantage of this excess, of this higher rate here, and look for dark matter type recoil signatures in the sort of 3 to 25 keV range. But the lower threshold depends on how low you can manage it. So it says 2 here, that's optimistic. But something like, say, 3 to 20 keV. And secondly, and this is a very important point about xenon, is again being heavy, it's a very good self-shielding medium. What is shown here are some simple simulations of essentially shooting gamma rays into a volume of either water or xenon down here. And this is 2.6 MeV gammas, and you can typically see there are many, many gammas entering here, but the whole collection of events, what you can see is about 20 centimeters of xenon, 40 centimeters of xenon, this whole thing is a meter. 40 centimeters of xenon absorbs, visually you can see how well it absorbs gammas, right? The same thing in water is not true. And here, the same thing is shown for different energy. This is 100, 500, and this is the 2.6 again. And so this sort of illustrates that if you have a cylinder of xenon and you just take out a peripheral volume as a shield, the inner core is relatively very pure in terms of backgrounds. And what that says is also that, but this only works if you go to sizes that are much larger than this attenuation length. So this automatically sets some threshold of about 300 kilograms or so for this to become really, when it starts paying off, when you have enough fiducial left over after you remove the periphery. So that was the reason we chose about 350 kilograms as a starting scale. Let me speed up a little bit here. This is another simulation. This is more detailed, illustrating the same point again for gammas. And here's your, the rate shown in these funny units called DRU, which is pounds per day, per kilogram, per keV. I didn't invent that, but that's what this this community uses. So once again, it says that it's self-shielding, first of all, and secondly, even if there is a gamma that gets in and scatters and comes back and scatters again in the fiducial, the double scatters we can always tag because we see two sets of S2 lights. That's sufficient to reject those events. And of course, for external gammas, we have the water shield. So similarly for neutrons, here's another simulation. You can see there's a nice, clean region in the middle. Once again, for neutrons, we tag about 65% with two double scatters. And the sources are mostly internal. They're coming from the largest background sources for the photomultipliers right now. For alpha M and also a little bit of fission. But it's much smaller overall than the gamma background. So that's the whole idea, that we reduce the internal background and absorb the external. And once again, the water shield acts as the absorber, but we're also considering adding gadolinium to the water to make it a good neutron detector by itself. And that's demonstrated here, as you know. If you have gadolinium inside of water, it has a very large cross-section for neutron absorption, and it leads to a cascade of gamma with energy of about 18 MeV, so which is easy to tag. There's some about 24 PMTs, large ones, 14-inch PMTs, inside of this water tank, so that's the efficiency for seeing that is near 100%. But and all you need to do is add about 0.2% of gadolinium. And there are several groups working on this. Different salts have to be evaluated. And I believe the favorite salt now is a nitrate, gadolinium nitrate. It has to do with how it attacks the systems around you, whether it corrodes or not. Okay, so here is shown the effectiveness of water for various types of background. you have the gammas in blue. This is the neutrons from the rock. So these are the lower energy ones, less than 10 MeV or so. And then these are the plasmogenic neutrons, which are the sort of just characterized here as greater than 10 MeV. And you can see those are more penetrating. But even there, we get at about, here's 2.5 meters, we get to order 10 minus 3. So, and the remainder, I mean, this is just for absorption, but as I said, you can always tag them as well. And we have water on all sides. If they exit, you have another chance at catching them. So this all relies on the fact that basically we can get very high purity water of the, and cheap. So you can get of the order of 10 minus 11 G per G. And it's water. It's cheap. It's easily scalable. When we go to our next design, you can easily imagine just buying more water. Okay, so what are the main parameters of NUTS? As I mentioned already, 350 kilograms of xenon. So here are the electric fields just mentioned for completeness. There are a total of 120 PMTs, 60 on each side, and these are Hamamatsu R8778s. These are no longer state of the art, but those are the ones we have. Hamamatsu has, I'll mention some more on that later, they have now invented even lower background PMTs. And these points I've already made. The bottom line is there will be 100 kilograms achievable in that central blue fiducial volume. Now, again, I suppose you've seen this many times, but just let me briefly mention how xenon works in terms of gamma neutron dissemination. When you have a recoil, you release energy into direct excitation of xenon or into ionization. The ionization goes through this chain with the ions, and through some recombination, once again, reach this one stage that leads to scintillation light. So initial light, which is this direct scintillation, direct excitation, and some recombination both lead to light. And what's left over, the non-recombined charge, is your so-called the electron signal or S2 light. But you can imagine that since the total energy for event is going either into excitation or ionization, the sum total would be same. So it's how it gets divided, S2 and S1, that discriminates electron recoils from neutron recoils or nuclear recoils, because in the nuclear recoil case, there is more recombination. So the S2 and S1, the division of the two signals is different. I'll come back, I'll show more on this, but fortunately for us, that this discrimination actually gets better at lower recoil. Okay. Here's such a curve from xenon 10 point here. As you can see, this is really fortuitous. Okay, so here's some data from our test cell egg case. What you have is two different sources, the cell exposed to the electrons and neutrons. What is being plotted is this quantity log 10 of S2 over S1, the secondary, the charge signal divided by the scintillation signal. And here are the electron response, and the red line is sort of the median through that. Here is the neutron response, and that green line is reproduced here on this curve. So the idea is that if you can reject everything above the green line, or in terms of if you want to view it as 99% rejection, that is that black curve there, which is quite similar to this green line, right? So if you reject everything up there, the remaining region down here is your dark matter region. And if you have no neutrons, because you've tagged them all away, this region should be empty or dark matter signal. Now, this is a simulation of that for LUX. Previously was data. This is the calibration data. This is simulation. And this is a simulation for 300 days running, 10 months, 100 kilograms dilution, as I said earlier. Here's the sort of expected background based on how much material we have inside the detector, and we know its radioactivity. And what is interesting is that after 300 days, in the fiducial, and this is again testimony to their self-shielding, that's all the events you'd expect. You can count it, right? Now, and this is once again the mean of, this curve is a little bit different from the S2 or S1 because it's flattened. So-called flattened, it's been divided by that line to make it easier to visualize. And this is the mean, and this is your dark matter sort of region here. And this curve illustrates the background-free nature that we will have after 10 months. And to further...
The previous plot does not seem the same than you showed before.
Than this?
Yeah.
Yeah, this is calibration data. This is just to show the shift.
In fact, since that the spillout in this picture is much higher than in the simulation you make later.
You can tell?
Yeah. Oh.
So you're saying this tail,
is much higher than...
I believe you. Because I can't tell. I can't tell. I can't tell what that should be. Because they're different cells. This is a simulation. If you think there's a difference, because this is actual data, and this is not the full detector. This is just a small... This is showing... This is a property of xenon. Okay? This is the property of what S2 or S1 you'd expect from xenon. And this is a simulation of a real device. So I don't think the comparison is valid. But if you want to doubt the tail, I disagree with you because I also don't believe in simulation. We'll see what we get after 10 months. Right? So I want to leave a point at all.
Just one question. The scales on the two plots, the other one was KVR and this one is KVEV.
Oh, yes. Good eyes. That is correct. Apparently, I had not even noticed. Because these are really two different things. So this is KVR because you don't really... Well, it's a question of how you collect the charge and then you have to convert to energy, right? So there's a scale for KVR, right? And this is for the experiment. Now, in this, since you're simulating gammas, you just know your KVEE that you started with. So that's the thing you plot. Okay? In the real experiment, we will need a calibration of the detector to convert from recoil charge or light or whatever to KVEE. Is that your question? I'm not sure.
I was wondering if you already knew what that calibration was, but
This is really simulations. I don't want to spend too much time on it. I just want to make
0.19 on the left. That's the calibration.
Oh, right. Okay.
Right, and then. Also, this is the sort of your quenching factor.
Yeah.
This is seen. But the point I wanted to make is this, and that was the reason for using the simulation, that, I mean, visually I said how few events you'd expect, right? But if you compare it to the state of the art, which was xenon 10, the published experiment, and this is their data after 96 or 59 days of running. And this is, for example, the previous plot was 300 days, this is 100 days. But this visually tells you the sort of the density of events you'll have. It'll be very quiet. That's the point. So we will have to do a great job in finding the tail. But given the smaller statistics, tails would be really at the level of Poisson fluctuations. They won't be Gaussian tails with so few events. Right? Okay. So that's the point I wanted to make. And the fact that if we go to the next step in more xenon, this just gets better and better. At some point, you'll have golden xenon in the center of a large detector, which will be very quiet. And that's just pushing the technology, the technique of using xenon. Okay, I don't know how much time I have. 15, oh, very good, okay. So this slide just summarizes our goals. And in the standard plot that everybody uses. But essentially, if we are aiming for 50% ejection, then we're assuming somewhere in the... Our goal is this, but as we do more and more, we're confident that we're reaching 99.8% level. Of course, we'll see when we build the full thing. Then the total rate we expect, and again, these units of the VRU of less than 8 × 10⁻⁴. Now, then we assume a 10-month run, as I said, 300 days, and 50% acceptance below that the neutron recoil curve. And that gives us something like in these units of 15,000 kilograms. And that translates into a dark matter reach. Again, for typical 100, what does it say? These blocks are for 100 GeV wind. Oh, I'm sorry, no, this is the versus the mass, right. So this one is a full reach, but this particular 4 × 10⁻⁶ is at, whatever that is, 40 GeV or so. And compare, so this is the projection for Lux 2009 and comparison to, this is the xenon 10 published limit, and then tomorrow I guess we'll hear about xenon 100, where that lies, and then also shown for comparison is super CDMS. And some assumption made about
2009 means you start the experiment in 2009.
That just means the plot was made in 2008.
Ah, okay.
It should now say 2010. Thank you. But I can cheat and say yeah because we see it. No, this is our original plot, so I use
so that. Then it's for 300 days.
Right. No, so that's it. These things haven't changed. Experiment has been delayed by a year, but I'll say some more about where we stand now. Okay, this is too much detail. If somebody wants, I can. You can look. This is a table of those earlier numbers that I said. But let me just come now to where we stand. Where do we stand now? So this is the experiment we proposed. We have, a year ago, we got the funding, so I think we're in good shape in terms of, it's not a very expensive detector, but we have what we need. So we are also accepted as part of what is called the Home States Early Implementation Program, or Sanford Lab. We are scheduled to go in. We are producing the components. We have been assigned a surface facility at the site, at Sanford Lab, where we can assemble the detector. And this is the anticipated date for when we can start moving underground. But we will be fully assembled on the surface, so it's really a sort of intact move. It's not a tear down and rebuild, but we are planning to move the device pre-assembled. And I'll just show you some pictures of what we've been doing. This is the so-called Lux 0.1, which is a part of Lux that has been operating at Case University, Case Western. And just to show you the sort of signals we expect, here is some samples from this detector. And they have been superposed several events. So you can see the S1 light and then corresponding S2 light. There's some more pictures. This vessel, as I said, this is a copper vessel, but in the real experiment, we are building a titanium vessel. And those of you who are in the business may be curious, so I put up a slide, and we were surprised ourselves. So actually, we evaluated several types of titanium, and they come in these chemical purities. So just in case you're curious, CP1 is quite good, and here are some numbers. For all of these samples, we really just measured upper limits of CP1, and they are really quite low. They're comparable to some pure copper. Now this scandium 46 is a carcinogenic, is an activation of titanium, but it was only in the samples. We mentioned it here because the samples went through air shipment, whereas the real materials did not, went through ground shipment, so that won't be there. There's some more pictures. This is to show that our level of readiness. Here's the grid, the PMT holders, the PMTs, and we've have some improvements in the data acquisition system by there's some intelligent electronics. So all of this S1 and S2 pulse shape finding, et cetera, happens in real time using a central FPGA. This is the work of Rochester University. There has been, as I said, work going on a case for krypton removal. This is a gas chromatography technique. We have a column in which you have relatively different diffusion rates, so to speak, for krypton versus xenon. So here you feed the column, and then you purge it after the krypton comes out, and then you recover all the xenon. And basically, as you can see, all the krypton is gone, and the xenon is purified here. One thing is that this seems to be taking hour and a half or whatever, 2 hours. And this is an older plot. Now, effort has been made to shrink this and make the recovery faster so you can process more and more xenon. And this has achieved about less than about 2 ppt. I'm not even sure we need that, but it's a totally, for me, it's just a demonstration of this technology for the next level. I believe 10 or 20 ppt is good enough. And we processed 25 kilograms so far, but this is being speeded up, so we process all of it well in time for the detector. This is the rate, 2 kilograms per day. This is just a picture of the surface facility that's being built at Sanford Lab. And just to remind you, this is where we're going in is the old Davis Cavern at the Home State Mine. And here are some pictures of this is the old tank used by Davis. And okay, some more plants. But this is the milestone. And this is just last month. They finally got in again. And because, as you know, the mine was full of water, so now they removed the water and entered. So now we believe that now we can measure progress. Until now, it was hard to see because they hadn't inspected the cavern, and now they've inspected it. They think that it's in good shape. We didn't know what we'd find once we drained the water. So I think it's going to happen now, fast. We had a collaboration meeting there in the middle of winter. Give Bob Sabora trying not to be cold. Okay, now just a 5 minutes on what we're planning next. What has happened is while we're building Lux, we've also formed a new collaboration. And this is the Zeppelin group, and Nigel is going to talk about it tomorrow, a little bit, I think. We've combined joint forces and formed what, for lack of imagination, LZ collaboration. And then there are two phases that the LZ collaboration has proposed or in the process of proposing, a 3-ton scale and a 20-ton scale. So from 300 to 3,000 to 20,000 in steps. These are all the new groups. There have been some new US groups also who joined this LZ20 effort. And we are fast approaching now 100 people collaboration. And the whole idea is to scale up. And some of the main points about the scaling up, what's needed. And these are the points. But I think the purity, I think, has been demonstrated. It is whether you can do this at 20,000 and how many, what sort of production line you need to do that needs to be worked out. But there's no showstopper there. So it's an engineering problem, not fundamental. We have the light collection itself is not a problem because we know the attenuation, et cetera, is xenon is fortunately very transparent, so it's 186 nanometer light. So that's not a problem. Background, well, that needs work. As I said, PMTs are the largest source inside the detector itself. Now, times 10 improvement is likely. In fact, the tubes that Hamas is making for X mass, I forget what the number is, they already have demonstrated that, right? So I don't know how much further we can go, but this times 10 is likely. So that will tell us how much of this reduction, how much of the 20 tons is reduced, right? So whether it's 60% or 90%, will depend on what PMPs we get, right? So that's a sort of moving scale. It's a question of what you achieve. This, we believe that we can understand, right? And then, as I said, this from the water tank. So our goal is achieving fiducial mass 80% at 3 tons and 90% at 20. Now, as I said, that's the moving scale. If that's 80, it's still a good experiment, right? That's just the state of the art. And this, as I mentioned already, that this is understood. This is being addressed. It seems like a boring point, but safety is a big deal, and we're really simultaneously addressing all of that with the Sanford lab. This is a question mark, and all of you who are in the xenon business know this, that when you talk about 20 tons of xenon, you got to say where you're going to find it, even if you have the money. So the world production is 45 tons per year. So we have to work on some creative procurement methods, including perhaps renting the xenon. We're considering it actively. I was mentioning at breakfast, the xenon we bought for lakhs went up in value immediately. And if we had just sold it a few months later, we could all have pocketed $1 million or something. So it has a great resale value. Companies already said, yeah, they're willing to leave. In fact, we give them pure xenon and they give us because we remove the crypto, et cetera. So they're getting better xenon back. But it has to be worked out how you do that. Okay. Here's a. I want to start a controversy here, and I'll blame these two guys for putting this together, Dan Aykroyd and Gates too. But here's an estimate of, just in case you're wondering, comparison of these technologies. And this, the way it's done is the following. You take these, you say, first of all, what energy threshold is a good assumption? And you may argue whether it's 2 or 3. And then, for that threshold, what sort of signal acceptance that you assume? So here are those numbers. There are two different levels for argon 40 and 80, depending on which technology you're going with. And then you say, okay, what is the fiducial mass required? And this is for, again, this 100 GeV wind, this sort of cross-section. How much fiducial mass is required to collect 25 events in 100 light days? This is just some arbitrary benchmark. It's not important why that. But if you just say that, to compare apples to apples, this tells you the scale. So 100 kilograms, which is lux, is equivalent to 1.5 tons or 6.5 tons of argon. And now, careful here, argon is assumed, I should mention somewhere, natural argon. There's no depletion. So if you have depletion, of course, that will change in this in terms of number of the electron recoil events that are allowed in that fiducial mass in this 100 light days. And here are those estimates. So that sort of gives you this leakage, right? That essentially we can live with this large leakage compared to these argon numbers of like 10 minus 9, et cetera. So I think we hear about argon experiments in that range of 3 tons or 4 tons. And from this type of analysis, the message is that it is equivalent to the lux 100 kilograms within some factor 2 or something, not making a finer point than that. Okay, in terms of how or when we think we can do it, well, this is where we are. We think we'll be operating lux in 20 tons. But we are simultaneously proposing the next stage, so we hope to be constructing the following year, 2011, and operating that for 2 years here. And this is the so-called S4 process, which you probably all heard about in the US, NSF process. So that already is in the works. We haven't heard the result of that process, but assuming that goes through, there will be a design deuce at this sort of end of 2010. NSF hasn't moved that date yet, but I believe it'll slip a little bit here. But that's our goal, is somewhere in, say, early 2011, have the design for the 20-ton, and of course then followed by another year and a half of a final report development. So depends on one of the fun. This is sort of the vagueness in this whole process, but there is some T0 where you get money. And then we're proposing something like a 2 to 2.5, 3 year process of from when you get the money to construction. But with this sort of optimistic schedule, we show taking data in 2016 with the large detector. Many question marks, right? Okay. As I said, this was the one new thing we need is this PMT R&D, and these are larger PMTs, 3-inch, and they're already being evaluated. And this is their goal of 1 millibecquerel. For background, and here are some results saying how nice single P whatever. And then I think this is my last slide. In terms of again that plot, but this is now the Lux. Now it says 2010, thankfully. Then this is the estimate for LZ3, and this is for LZ20, and that's sort of at the dip here, looks like 10 minus 49. At some point, you have to say, I don't understand all this theory stuff, but is this really a likely theoretical space? Or at that point, you say, there's no neutralino wind. So somewhere you have to quit, because the equivalent is 10 minus 65, if you say go all the way to value.
Well, you will have seen it by that time.
Okay. All right. Okay. So here's my summary. Nothing important here except just a few bullets on exactly what I've already said. So thank you.
Question? First of all, I'm delighted that you're dry at Davis level. Is there going to need to be new ground control work or any of that sort of stuff done? Or
there will be a new floor. Is that what you
mean? No, I mean ground control. I mean rock bolting, that kind of thing.
Yeah. We hope not. You mean, yeah, that survey is happening right now to see if somebody comes and says all these rock boards need to be replaced. That's a serious setback in our schedule. So we're hoping it's only water. It shouldn't have done anything. You know, so we're hoping no, but the answer is we don't know yet.
And where would LZ3 go? Would it go at the Davis level or below?
Yes, very important. So thank you. LZ3 is going to use the same water tank. It fits in there. For the LZ20, we'll need a new tank.
Is Davis deep enough for neutrons?
As you saw somewhere, I have the neutron plot. That is not our biggest problem. Cosmic is. Our biggest background is just rock and internal. If that's your question, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that was it.
Oh, here it is. So this is sort of the depth dependent number, right? And we'll use the same water tank, so this rate will be the same, won't change. But as I've said, this is already, I can't read. Okay, this is a relative number, it's not an absolute, right? I don't have it here, but we've done the absolute number too. This is not at all a limiting background. We expect, this water tank is going to see, just to give you a ballpark, it's going to see a few events per hour. Of this nature, that's the level. It's very small, yeah. I know which order.
How do you plan to manage the fact that this detector, I think, as has been demonstrated by the previous version, and Zeppelin and also Xenon and so on, has not a uniform light collection, light response. Mm-hmm. And also, another important point is the energy threshold that you claim to be lower than 2 kV, I think, no? Because in some plot and some simulation, you put 2
kV. 2 is a bit consistent, but I said it's optimistic, so, and you may take 3.
With just a small light response, about a few photoelectrons per kV. It's the same as the previous version. You know that when you scale up from 10 kilos to 100 kilos, the situation becomes worse. This is true. And it is not so good now, so my guess is the situation will be also worse than
We have people in our collaboration who were part of Xenon 10, and I'm not one of them. So I can't directly comment on what was wrong with the light response understanding of Xenon 10. I can't say two ways here.
The question is,
it can just as well be to you, but the question is, the two questions, as I understand it. One is, the light response to Xenon 10 was not 100% understood. And how do you feel confident now you can do it for a larger detector? That's question one. And second, how do you propose to, that I could answer actually on the, trigger. The short answer for part two of the question is, we plan to trigger on a single PE. And we've got several improvements on that front, including the electronics that I showed. So we, and
the light response is different for S1 and S2 as well. You get a lot more light in S2 where you can see a single electron coming off the surface.
Yeah, liquid electron.
Triggering on S2, then you're looking back from S1 signal.
Right, and that also with electronics, with intelligence and trigger with memory, you can trigger differently. You look for S2 and then you record it history for a couple milliseconds, and you go back and say, was there a decent S1? And then, I believe our data acquisition rate is sort of 50 times larger than earlier experiments, so we can take a lot of events. We don't have to worry so much. So there are lots of improvement on the second one. But I'll let you address the optics.
Just two things. I mean, the threshold was 2 kV electron for the instruction. And we actually understood the light very well from calibrations. We had uniform source calibrations using activated xenon. So we actually mapped the light response to our detector every cubic second year using the.
You were talking about the time of this map.
We are monitoring the stability of PMTs. It depends on the PMTs. So we monitored the stability of the PMTs, which was stable within 2%, and the rest being reduced from the map.
Okay, so maybe we should move on for a second.
Just one quick question. When you are so sensitive, you'll be presumably also detecting the solar neutrinos through their neutral currents, and are you planning any studies on that?
There has been a study and a plot. I don't have it. By lunch, I'll put it up. So it is below, and it's very sharply falling curve.
That's true.
Right, so again, I mean, that's the 2 or 3 kVs. I mean, this falls right at the threshold level, the solar signal. So hopefully when we're 20 ton and we have more data, we could be separating the two ranges, the dark matter range and solar range.
That's if you scatter on the nucleus, but if you ionize the atoms, then you will be some extra contribution to.
I'm sorry, I still don't know if I know the answer to that. You're saying neutrino atom interaction?
Right, so you have the recoil and you also have ionization. Yes. I mean, maybe it's not.
I must say, I've never considered that, so we can talk more. I don't know the answer to that.
All right, let's quickly move on to the next speaker.